Maayad, ayad na nga atlaw. Welcome back to the Philippine X and Wellness Podcast. This is Cheryl Sampson Ramirez, co-founder and co-host. We are excited to bring to you episode 4 of our 5th season titled Local Food Tukamayan. Co-host with me on this episode is Ms. Sheena Katz. We are interviewing social ecology, environmental design, and food systems expert Dr. Amber Heckelman, as we talk about food systems and how it relates to the overall realm of health and wellness. Dr. Amber Heckelman comes to us from the Greater Vancouver area of British Columbia, Canada. We hope that you enjoy this episode. Maayad ayad nang adlaw. Welcome to the 4th episode of our 5th season for the Philippine X and Wellness Podcast. I am your host, Cheryl Sampson Ramirez, and my pronouns are she, her, sha. For this episode's audio description currently, I have a gray t-shirt. I'm wearing red and white eyeglass frames over my eyes, have black long hair with some blue highlights, wavy at the end. And I have a black curtain to my left and some wooden slates to my right. Co-hosting this episode, I have Ms. Sheena Katz.
Hello, everybody. This is Sheena Katz, your co-host for the day. And for my audio description, I am wearing a long gray V-neck sweater. My hair is down and I'm seated in front of a blue impressionist painting behind me.
Following our last episode, Radical Visibility with Sky Kubakub, in lieu of our melatonin, vitamin D, and sleep episode with Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino, we will be pivoting to welcome to our podcast social ecology, environmental design, and food systems expert Dr. Amber Heckelman to talk to us about local food Tukamayan.
And as mentioned in previous episodes, all views discussed are for informational and educational purposes only. It is not meant to be medical advice, nor does it constitute therapy or professional advice. As always, please consult with your healthcare practitioner, especially before starting any exercise or new health program or a qualified mental health professional for your particular condition. So without further ado, we'd like to welcome to the podcast Dr. Amber Heckelman.
Thanks so much for having me. Super excited to be here. Super excited to be in conversation with your listeners. So thankful that you guys got up early in the morning to do this podcast with me.
Well, we are thrilled that you are here. So thank you for making time for us. So Dr. Heckelman, we always love to kick things off by learning a little bit more about where our guests come from. So can you share where both of your families are from, both sides, and where you're joining us from today?
Yeah, and if you don't mind, it is in my practice to do land acknowledgement. So should I do that here?
We'd love that.
Yeah. Okay, great. So I use she, her pronouns, and I'll also sort of describe myself and where I'm at. So I'm sitting here in my kitchen. I've got my hair clipped back, got my headset on, didn't bother with any makeup this morning. I wish I had, but I didn't really have time. So I'm looking a little bit bland right now. I'm wearing a long sleeve black shirt with a sweetheart cut neck. And I think I've got a little bit of a, I guess my background is I have some shelves and some cabinets, and I have the entryway to one of my staircases. And yeah, I think that covers it. Hopefully I'm not missing anything, you guys. Feel free to let me know if I am. But all right, so I'm joining you all today from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Kwantlen, Matsqui, Katsi, and Simiamu First Nations. And otherwise, this area is known as Langley, BC, which is part of the Greater Vancouver area in British Columbia, Canada. It's a very beautiful place to live and raise a family. So I'm super appreciative to be here. But also want to just recognize that I live here uninvited. And that's something that all settlers, even those of us who immigrated here, that can tie our immigration and, you know, sort of larger diaspora to the legacies of colonialism in our own home countries. This is something we certainly have to wrestle with. And that's just sort of the reality of our existence and persistence on unceded lands. And so I do just want to recognize that. So obviously, I'm not originally from here. I moved here in 2014 for graduate school. Ended up loving it here. I love the beautiful natural setting. And so I ended up staying. I love the amalgamation of cultures that's here as well. And I really like the vibe, which, you know, I found to be quite palpable in terms of like this consciousness for sustainability, this consciousness for social justice, this consciousness for settler colonialism, and, you know, sort of like the interest in advancing reconciliation. Like all of that I found to be very inspiring, and wanted to continue to learn in this space with everybody. But so this is getting pretty lengthy, but I just wanted to say, yeah, I'm from Southeast San Diego, which is in Southern California, of course, raised by my mom and my dad. My mom primarily, I come from a divorced family, but I was primarily raised by my mom, found herself alone, having raised two kids in low-income housing. Yeah, to give you some context, you know, I'm first generation Filipino American, but also first generation university graduate. My mom was the only one in her family who left the Philippines. And so I'm finally getting to your question there, Sheena's. So my mom is Filipina. She's from the Visayan Islands, from Southern Leyte in particular. So my family is from Sogod, Southern Leyte. And they've now branched out to other parts of the Philippines. And my generation, so my cousins have, a few of them have also branched out to other parts of the world. And then my dad, who unfortunately passed just a couple years ago, solid good man. He was a third generation German, Scottish, and Irish American. And so that side of my family settled in Michigan, in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where most of them, I think, still live, yeah, today. So I guess getting back to your question, once again, in a nutshell, I'm mestiza. So of mixed background, mixed heritage. But I always feel like inclined to also share that that also comes with a mixed socioeconomic status, background, and understanding, because I grew up in sort of two worlds. So my mom being hardworking immigrant woman, raising two kids on her own, really struggled to make ends meet, you know, and so I kind of know firsthand what it looks like and what it feels like to be poor. My dad also being very hardworking, but also had the privilege that comes with being white, being a white male in America, right? So he climbed the corporate ladder, did well for himself, wasn't rich by no means, probably, you know, solid middle class, but he gave me a sense of what it feels and looks like to have, you know, financial security and stability and to live comfortably. So anyway, I say all of that just to say, you know, I always kind of find myself in liminal spaces, and I think that'll come through in our discussion today. I'm never quite here, never quite there. I'm sort of always in these spaces in between, sort of navigating connections, you know, bridging different worlds and perceptions. And I do think that has a lot to do with my background and my upbringing. You know, I generally don't fit in anywhere, but I do find myself adapting and blending in everywhere, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of our listeners will resonate with that too, just because being a Filipino American, you have to live that duality daily. And I think you're doing it in a different even level. So people will really resonate with that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I want to say, I appreciate the thoroughness of your introduction, Amber. I don't think we've had any other guests that has really dived into the different intersectionalities that they've grown up with as being a part of the diaspora. And I think you did so eloquently and thoroughly. It really provides context to our diaspora in terms of the different types of backgrounds that make up who we are as Filipinos or Philippine X. not just racial makeup, socioeconomic is important, and also origin stories of where our upbringing takes place and how that influences us as individuals. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I'm going to be like, no, thank you. But it's the way that you guys designed, I think, your questions. So it gets me to sort of open up and think a little bit more deeply. So thank you for the opportunity to think through it. No. Thank you.
But let that be the thread of today's discussion, right? As we talk about local food Sukumayan, I think that's important context to run through this discourse that we're about to have. And first, Amber, we wanted to just publicly thank you for interviewing us initially, because when Philippinex and Wellness started in our initial session, like via the Clubhouse app, no podcast, everyone like, where's their first season? It was on the Clubhouse app, right? And we didn't have an opportunity to record any of those sessions yet. And back then, you featured us on Vancouver's co-op radio station, 100.5 FM CFRO. What did CFRO stand for again?
Oh, I forget. Okay. But it's community radio, basically. So it's like a community-run radio program.
All good. I mean, well, you know, we're traveling back into time here, right? Back into our brains.
Yeah. And clearly, I'm no longer a radio host. It's been a few years now. So,
I mean, that was back in like October 2021, right?
Yeah.
And so this is when Jeepney Cafe's Land, Life, and Liberation program was happening. You did it in collaboration with John Nieto and Jordan Laksamana. Shout out to the both of them.
Yeah, John and Jordan. They were like one of the first people I met when I moved out here.
Yeah, amazing. And amazing connections. We had Jordan on also for our cycling and wellness episode with Nelson Raboy. So one of these days we're going to have to get John out onto the podcast. But just wanted to, shout them out. Like I'm shouting out like, you know, New Kids on the Block members here. But Jordan. So that's dating us, dating me as we made that reference. Now, 4 years later, we're interviewing you on the topic of local food Sukumayan. We discussed this in our initial planning meeting, Amber, but let's contextualize for our audience why we titled this episode Local Food Sukumayan. Give us a brief overview of what we'll be discussing today as it relates to the title of this episode.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get oriented here. So local food movements, I think, are really interesting spaces. And they're spaces that are evolving, right? The sort of leaders, thinkers, and then even the wider discourse on local food movements, I think, over time are becoming increasingly diverse. And so what I'm hoping to do is to compel all of your listeners and the wider Pilipinx community to be a part of the local food movement, because, I mean, just point blank, you know, we matter, for one, and we have very powerful stories. We have a beautiful and rich food culture, and we deserve to shape how our communities grow, share, and celebrate food. And I want to take a moment to really unpack why I think this is so important. So when you look back at the organic food and farming movement that really started to gain momentum in the 1970s, it had a meaningful impact in that it started to draw attention to how food is being produced. You had like really seminal pieces of work like Francis Morlepe's Diet for a Small Planet. You had like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. These are like seminal books that really started to get people to understand, you know, the detrimental impact modern industrial agriculture was having on regions across the world, right? And this is because modern industrial farming systems, they're largely monocultures that are managed with agrochemicals, you know, countless fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, and so on, that are very toxic to the environment, and they're toxic to people too, right? So think about the resource poor farmers and farm workers that have to handle and apply these toxins on a regular basis, like the kinds of exposure they're getting to these substances. So the world at the time, you know, to some degree, was starting to see and make connections between large-scale monocultures and ecological degradation, connections between agrochemicals and water pollution and eutrophication. You know, we start to even more recently become increasingly aware of the health implications of long-term exposure to these toxins, not only on our health, like the people who are actually consuming these food products, but also, again, like I mentioned, the health of the farmers is starting to get centered in a lot of this discussion, like thinking about the farmers and the farm workers who are having to constantly apply and handle these chemicals. And that's just like the tip of the iceberg, right? I haven't even gone into some of the power dynamics that are at play with modern industrial agriculture and some of the land grabbing that has been facilitated over time, the peasant movements that are responding to land concentration and these kinds of land grabs, like in the Philippines, across Asia and Latin America, and all over the world, really. There are so many problems with these kinds of large industrial agricultural systems. And, you know, it's sort of, I can go on and on. We can just spend the whole time just talking about all of the problems that they've caused around the world. Now, the local food movement is one of a collection of food and farming movements that are currently underway all over the world. You know, we have like the food sovereignty movement that is really trying to bring together the voices of peasants and indigenous peoples from across the globe who are advocating for the right to control their own food systems. And in these kinds of protests and advocacies, they're really emphasizing local control over how food is produced, local control over how it's distributed, how it's consumed. You also have like agrarian reform movements, like in the Philippines, where farmers are fighting, you know, some of the legacies of colonialism and the ongoing land concentrations, right? So fighting to recover land to grow food for their families and communities. And so you have all of this happening at the same time, right? So, but what makes at least the history of local food movements in North America a bit different is that it has or had this tendency, and to some degree still does, to reflect an affluent and primarily white demographic group, right? So imagine a local farmer's market. Who do you see present, you know, in these spaces? Imagine, you know, a local grocer that supplies primarily, you know, local organic free trade types of food products. You know, what types of foods are available in these stores? And I ask these questions also realizing that times are changing. Like I mentioned earlier, like the discourse is diversifying, leadership in these spaces is diversifying. But largely there's this history, and to some extent in many places across North America, it's still very affluent, it's still very white. Yeah. And so that's something that we have to sort of wrestle with, right? And to bring it back to, you know, the greater Vancouver area where I'm living now, you know, there was an interesting study that was done just a few years ago that attempted to explore why the local food movement and farmers markets here in the greater Vancouver area are so white. And to give you some context, yeah, sure, there are plenty of white farmers in BC, but there are also plenty of Chinese and Punjabi farmers here in the province and even in this region where I'm at. So why weren't they being represented? And what this study found was that there was little to no effort that was being made to be inclusive. You know, non-white farmers just weren't being invited to participate in these farmers markets. And they didn't have a seat at the table, right? At the decision-making table. They weren't necessarily included. And this is, it's this kind of dynamic that I'm trying to underscore here. You know, we need to make sure that local food movements are defined by a diversity of voices and experiences and perceptions and worldviews. You know, if we want to create a food system or transform our food systems to be, you know, all the things that we want it to be, right? We want it to be equitable. We want it to be just. We want it to be sustainable and climate resilient. You know, if we want to make sure that people have access to culturally appropriate food, if we want to make sure that people in our community don't go hungry, you know, if we want to make sure that we don't destroy the planet and we don't cause harm to the people who are having to grow our food, we need to make sure that we have a diversity of voices that are shaping food policy, that are shaping food programs, and who, you know, are having a say in shaping, you know, spaces in our communities where we can connect with and celebrate our various food traditions. And Filipinos, I mean, we know how to celebrate with food, right? Like, we know. We
our
know,
love language.
Right? Yeah, it's our love language. We have a very strong and powerful connection also with the farm worker movement in the 1960s in California, led by Larry Itliong alongside Cesar Chavez. And so we have a stake in this fight, and we are part of a very long time struggle that was galvanized by previous generations. And so I invite, you know, this is, I guess the premise of all of this is to really invite more and more Filipinos to be in these spaces, to be leaders in these spaces, and to shape what they look like and feel like.
Wow. I mean, I'm thinking about all the things that you're saying, Amber, and what's current. We're recording on June 29th, Sunday, 2025, and what's currently impacting our communities. Sheena and I are in the Los Angeles area under Antangva and Chumash and Gabrielino territory. What's current here for us are also the active detention of undocumented workers who also work on a lot of the farms that you're mentioning. We're in California, right? And so a lot of the things that you're saying make me pretty emotional. We're located in the urban area of Los Angeles, but even when you go north or south or east of us, in where a lot of these agricultural fields are still in existence and really creating food and crops for the entire nation, they are under attack and being removed from these spaces. So it's a very difficult thing to hear you even talk about bringing those voices to the table when right now they're under attack.
Yeah.
And in the process of being erased.
Yeah. It's awful. I mean, I'm searching for the right word, and sometimes words just escape you when you have to think about these kinds of situations and what folks are having to endure. I mean, it's a reminder also of, like, I don't know if you everybody's always reflecting back at, you know, COVID times during the pandemic, but this was also a group that was overlooked and not taken care of and not protected, but expected to continue to provide for our communities. They experience a lot of oppressive conditions that that are really violations to human rights, and it's awful.
And I'm only talking about the context in California alone. We're not even looking at it from a global perspective that I know your research has dived into, even that we're going to unpack in this episode as we continue to talk about the Philippines as well. I'm going to let Sheena chime back in here.
Yeah, pivoting a little bit, actually. So it's been about 10 years since you did your research on climate resilience in organic versus conventional rice systems across four neighboring villages in Negros Occidental.
Yeah.
Research that actually ended up shaping your doctoral dissertation at UBC. Can you tell us what drew you to that topic and what were some of the biggest takeaways from your time there?
Oh, gosh. This is a messy answer, only because there are many things that were influencing my reasoning for doing this work. Personal reasons. I use it as an opportunity to sort of reconnect with my roots, sort of speak. Like, I wanted to go and be able to spend time and learn as much as I could about the country where my mom was from, right? And so that's why I selected the Philippines. But there are other reasons why the Philippines made the most sense to do this work. It was at the time one of the foremost countries that was being impacted by climate change, right? We've had a number of typhoons wreak havoc throughout the country. The Philippines is located in the Pacific Ring of Fire. And so they're constantly susceptible to typhoons and these kinds of conditions. And so it made sense to do this work there. I also, forged a partnership with a farmer-led organization called Masipag. And I came across their work. I read a book that looked at, did a comparison between organic and conventional farming systems and kind of showed like how much better off organic farmers were. And so Masipag is really at the front lines of the organic food movement in the Philippines and the food sovereignty movement in the Philippines. And I was really inspired by some of the work that they were doing. And I was inspired that it was an organization that was farmer-led. And so these, peasants, resource-poor farmers, they're the ones who are leading and directing this network. And so I felt like, okay, they're getting an understanding and trying to address that power dynamic that comes with like researchers going and the agricultural industry going into these spaces and claiming they're the knowledge holders. This group is taking it back and saying like, no, we are actually leaders in this space and we're the knowledge holders. And so I was quite inspired by that. So I all of that really motivated me to partner with them. I give them full credit. They came up with my research questions because I said I just wanted to do something that was meaningful for the work that you guys are doing in the organization. And they said that a lot of their farms are farmers across the Philippines were noticing that their farms were better off than their neighbors' farms after experiencing some kind of climate-related disturbance, like either, droughts or heavy rains, flooding, that sort of thing. They're noticing that their farms were better off, like more crops survived, their crops or their farms were able to withstand that kind of disturbance, whereas their neighbor conventional farms were like completely wiped out. And so they're trying to understand, why they were doing better. And first of all of this was anecdotal. So they wanted to see is this actually the case? Are these organic farms better off than their conventional neighbors? And why is this the case? And so that's what I ended up doing. And it was quite inspiring. And I was quite moved. I think one of the biggest lessons that I learned is that, these resource poor farmers, they're incredibly innovative. They're very sophisticated leaders in their communities. And they have a very deep knowledge of the environments in which they're managing their farms. And it just forces anyone who has exposure to this to take a step back and think very critically about research institutes, outsiders, industries that are trying to come in and say they have the solution and you can buy the solution from them. I'm more inclined to think that no, the solutions are with the people on the ground.
What are some connections that you take from that experience within your current arena of work around health and wellness, around food systems in the Greater Vancouver area?
Yeah, so have I worked with farmers here? Less so with farmers here. A lot of the work that I've been doing in BC has been within the like food access space, but also within the school food program space. So Canada up until recently was the only G7 country that didn't have a federally funded school food program, which sounds crazy because it's just crazy. So kids were just, bringing food from home every day. A lot of schools don't even have kitchens. And so if you think about like school food being like sometimes for many people, especially for families who are food insecure, schools are often the only place where a child can get like a full meal. And so if you think about it, it's not going to resolve food insecurity, but it's a very powerful tool for helping families mitigate some of the food insecurity that they might be experiencing. And so it's just crazy that Canada wouldn't have a federally funded and supported school food program. But that's changed. They do have one now. They're still sort of like working out what it's going to look like and trying to build it out across the country. So I've done some work around there to inform policy and help to advance, you know, efforts to create, you know, healthy, sustainable school food programs. And then I've also worked in the food access space. And so working with like, and really diving into and looking at like community-based programs, like food banks and meal programs, like those that are on the front lines of connecting people to food who need it most, to like who are experiencing food insecurity and hunger. And so looking at, you know, how this sector is augmenting food security, but also how they could potentially be a part of transforming food systems, you know, through like innovative models. And so to get to your question, Cheryl, about how has this like informed some of the work that I'm doing here is I am a very collaborative researcher. And I've always worked in a very collaborative and collective way. I find that people who are on the ground doing the work firsthand on the front lines, they hold a lot of knowledge. They're often like well connected in communities. And so they have that in-depth understanding of context and conditions. And so that never escapes me. I always try to tap into that and help that sort of guide me in the work that I do. I find a lot of hope in these spaces, like these spaces on the ground, like whether it's through like, you know, resource poor farmers in the Philippines or, you know, leaders or volunteers who are running food banks and meal programs, or teachers or not-for-profit organizations who are running meal programs at schools. I find like people are really inspiring, you know, like what really motivates them and drives them energizes me. I just get energized by their leadership, and I allow it to sort of like, it's the wind in my sail, you know?
Yeah. I get it. There's so much that I'm thinking about as you're speaking, from having farmers have the central voice to their work, their connection to the land that they live on, from coming from societies and cultures that are primarily agricultural, where we have that strong connection to the land. And how you mentioned are being cut off from that discourse and really shaping the food systems framework and the direction of where we're headed. Yet, as a consumer, as a daily consumer, we're going into grocery stores, we're just almost like moving about things robotically or mechanically. The average person, I want to say, without just sounding like I'm exerting judgment or assumptions, and just really taking things off the shelf to what will sustain us day by day, without really putting in depth or thought of all the things that you're mentioning, from exposure to chemicals, to oppressive working conditions, and what we mentioned earlier, detention and now deportation.
Ooh, I'll add another D. I think what you're getting at there, Cheryl, and correct me if I'm wrong, is like disconnection. I think our food system right now works in a way where it disconnects people. We feel disconnected from where our food comes from. A lot of people have done studies or have asked kids questions of like where vegetables come from, and they say the grocery store. A lot of the times they don't even know like food is grown in a field. A lot of the times people aren't making the connection anymore that drumstick is part of a chicken. It's actually it was a living thing. People aren't making those connections. And I think that the current food system and the way that it operates and the industries that serve to benefit from its current operations thrive in us being very disconnected. They make a lot of money as long as we stay very disconnected. And that's the key. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I wanted us to talk about the local food to combine, because I want our community to get connected, to be in these spaces and to make these kinds of important connections.
And thank you for mentioning that. And I think it's these connections that also impact why we're having you on a health and wellness podcast. We talk about as Filipinos or Philippine X in the diaspora, all the food that we get excited about eating at every family party or dinner that we have. We talk about food being our love language, but we don't always unpack the source of every ingredient that gets placed into these recipes that hold memories for us, memories that extend beyond the flavor of our nose, smelling the scents that are familiar to us and to our families that connect us to our homelands, but also the taste that reinvigorates our connections to our ancestral lineages. Now we're talking about things that are much deeper too than really thinking about who are the people that create these foods that we're able to enjoy on the daily. But Amber, I want to also come back to your origin story. We do this with every guest that we have on the podcast. Again, this is Cheryl speaking for those who are listening. I personally brought on Amber. She's one of my best friends and former college roommates. And I think it's funny that I'm asking you about your origin story, because there's more to you that has led you to do this work. We both were undergrads at UC Irvine. From there, you received 2 master's degrees in cultural anthropology and environmental science from Washington State University, having done your undergraduate degree in social ecology, environmental analysis, and design. And you even further, as you mentioned, pursued your PhD in integrated studies in land and food systems at the University of British Columbia in Canada. I sound like I'm orating your curriculum vitae right here. As you did a winged migration and flew north for the winter.
Oh, I love that.
And never returned. What inspired you to focus on land and food systems, social ecology, and environmental design? It's not like the everyday person will tell their parents, hey, I'm going to major in land and food systems, social ecology, environmental design. And they're probably, if they had Filipino or Filipinx parents, they'd look at them blankly and say, I don't know what you're doing, but as long as it puts food on the table and pays your bills, go for it. So
yeah,
any of it rooted in your upbringing that you mentioned earlier? And what, tell us about some of the life events that influenced you to pursue this path.
Yeah, for sure. No, I really appreciate this question. And it's not a straightforward answer. And certainly I had no idea that such a program, land and food systems, even existed until maybe I was a master's student. Yeah. So even in undergrad, I didn't know that this was a thing. So I guess I'll kick it off by saying, you know, one of the things that I'd like for your listeners to know about me is that, and it's something I had already mentioned, but I'm a first generation Filipino American, right? And I was primarily raised in a single headed household in an area that would be characterized as like low income housing. Now, the area that I grew up in was beautifully diverse, right? It was comprised of mostly immigrants and people of color. To give you a picture of what it looked like in my community, I mean, the ice cream trucks, I'm sure you guys had this too up in LA, but the ice cream trucks sold the best Mexican candies. There was like some homemade saladitos in there, you know, like we had, you know, that they were making it. They just put some rad wrap over it. We would love that stuff, right? There were women in the neighborhood who sold tamales door to door. You had the Filipino elders, you know, all the lolos and lolas. They were like collecting cans and recyclables all throughout the neighborhood. You know, what else do we have? We had like Black, Filipino, Latino break dancers. You know, they take out their cardboards with their boom boxes. I'm also dating myself, but the boom boxes, you know, they bring it out on the street and the parking lots or whatever and do their thing. It was a place that that was very vibrant, and I absolutely loved growing up in the community that I grew up in. But I mean, I have to be honest, it was also a community that was dealing with the struggles that come with being poor, right? And trying to survive racism and discrimination, but also, you know, the feelings of isolation, especially for immigrant families who, like my mom, were the only ones to leave, right? She was alone. There are a lot of families who felt alone because they were the only ones who left their country. So, you know, my community and all of its rich, you know, cultural diversity, I mean, it was also afflicted with gangs and drugs and violence, which often comes with, like, when you mix the two. And so one of the reasons why I'm pointing this out is that it wasn't until I went to university that I started to learn about, you know, historically marginalized and equity deserving groups and communities that I came to realize, you know, we're dealing with the long legacies of injustices that looked and felt very much like my community, you know? And I started to make that connection. You know, it took some time, but like, over time, those kinds of statistics or stories and messaging that I was hearing in a university caused me to be a little bit more self-aware about, like, where I come from and, you know, who my community was, you know, and some of the unique challenges that I think, you know, come from being a part of and growing up in an immigrant community, you know, some of the challenges that come with growing up and being raised in a single headed household. And so these are some of the things that, like, kind of started to come to a head for me when I was in university. And I started to grow up a passion for social justice. I also had an incredible roommate who was, like, out there protesting and, you know, picketing and all of that stuff. Yeah, I'm talking about you, Cheryl. You were out there. Okay. I saw you. You were like, huh? Who is this? That was you. And so I was surrounding myself with people who were out there and giving me a taste of, like, you know, what really matters and what I should be paying attention to. I also came to learn a lot about, like, environmental sustainability issues at the time. You know, it's like I got introduced to things like desertification, ecosystem degradation, biodiversity loss, like pollution, freshwater, all these concerns that we should really be worried about, you know. But I became, like, gravely concerned about them and worried about the state of the planet and our persistence and of life on this planet. And so that also became a passion for me. So I had this, you know, social justice and environmental sustainability that were kind of like two pillars of interest for me that I continued to explore. So after I graduated, I did my double major at UCI. You know, I set off to the world to do a lot of different things. You know, I worked as an intern for the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C., where I spent about 6 months, you know, building awareness of the impact confined animal feedlots were having on water quality, right? And here's where I got exposure to the environmental consequences, my first line of exposure to, you know, sort of environmental consequences of industrial agriculture. I was also a team leader for EnviroCorps, where I had an opportunity to work in partnership with, like, organizations like the Nature Conservancy on restoring natural landscapes in rural communities throughout the Midwest. I also returned, you know, to my hometown of Southeast San Diego, and I worked as a regional manager for before and after school programs located in communities that were very close to the communities or the community that I grew up in. And I helped to, you know, get started a couple of school gardens at the schools that I oversaw. And then this is sort of like, you know, after doing, like, all of these different things, it was still quite messy. I didn't quite have it all organized in my mind, but I think I started to have, like, an inflection point where I was like, huh, engaging with the food system offered a very powerful way for me to work on both social justice issues and environmental sustainability issues. But I felt like, you know, there's so much more that I still wanted to know, that I needed to learn, that I didn't understand. And so I decided to go back to grad school to try to dig a little bit more. And that's when, you know, I got my master's degrees. And I was really starting to explore food systems a little bit more intentionally at the time. And I just was very interested in like that human environment relationship and how that shapes the food system, but also how the food system shapes, you know, human environment relationships. But okay, so, you know, that brings us to, you know, like me deciding to pursue my PhD at UBC. And that's where, you know, we've talked about it already. I forged that partnership with Masipag. And gosh, you know, I can't say enough how powerful that experience was for me, because I learned sort of firsthand how powerful farmers can be, like how powerful collective action can be, the power of coalition building, all of that. And yeah, I don't know. Does that answer your question, Cheryl? As I told you, it's a bit of a messy answer. It's not like, you know, when you're a kid, they're like, oh, what do you want to be? I want to be a lawyer or a doctor. It wasn't that. It was like, I'm just going to go where my heart and interest is right now and try to figure it out.
Yeah, that sounds very you.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, also, as you talk about your research in the Philippines and also in North America, can I ask you, what are some distinctions that you've unpacked from your research and experience there versus working with farmers there, right, from your research, and also working or being a part of local food movements in the Greater Vancouver area? Have you encountered distinctions in terms of the experiences from farmers there? Because it's not like the everyday person has exposure to rice farms in the Philippines. Yes, maybe most people, when we're traveling back home to the motherland and we enter the province, we might drive by these farmlands, right? These rice farms, and see the source of where our rice is coming from. But it's not that we have the direct access to the knowledge and the experience that you had during your time there. And I'm curious to know, what are some of the takeaways that we should know as Filipinos in the diaspora, along with the distinctions that you've experienced from both being there and in the Greater Vancouver area? I know you also have questions for us, but I'm going to start there before you turn the table on us.
Yeah. This is a really good question. So, yeah, I think one of the first things that comes to mind for me is that in the Philippines, it was very clear and palpable that the resource-poor farmers that I had an opportunity to learn from and work with, not only their livelihoods are under constant threat, but even their lives are under threat. It's a very different, I guess, degree of conditions that they're having to survive in, right? I can't say the same here in BC, although I think that maybe if you were to talk to an Indigenous community here, they would feel the same kind of degree of oppression that a lot of resource poor farmers are feeling in the Philippines. And I mean, just to give you an example, there was a farmer organization that was a partner organization to Masipag that I was also working with when I was there. And it was founded and run by an agrarian reform lawyer, attorney Ben Ramos. And this is a place, like, he lived on the compound where the organization operated. This is where I lived while I was there doing my research. And so I was quite familiar, and his house and his family was kind of near the building that I was living in, and very, like, it was all one, like, main compound in Negros Occidental. I think it was maybe not even a year after I had returned and come home that he was gunned down. This was under Duterte. So just outside of his home, just outside of that compound. And he was somebody who was fighting for agrarian reform, fighting for landless peasants to get access to their land that was either grabbed or taken for them, or that they deserved through agrarian reform policies. And this is a story that's told over and over again throughout the Philippines, right? Peasants are, they are dealing with quite a number of afflictions and challenges that I can't say the farmers here in BC are dealing with that degree of oppression and violence, right? So that's the biggest difference that comes to mind. The other one, and, you know, shifting up my entire sort of tone here, is, so one of my mentors in the Philippines, and he was also one of the staff of Masipag, so working for the network, he was great. He was always talking to me about, you know, why Philippines is so great. One of the things is, he would always point out, in the West, in North America, we're so worried about food waste, right? Like, we 30-40% of our food just goes into the garbage, into the landfill. It's a real problem if you think about all of the resources that go into growing that food, and then all of the people who are hungry, and that food just gets thrown away. It's crazy. But he would always talk about how they don't waste anything. They use the whole animal, right? Food doesn't go into the landfill, because then they feed it to, you know, the chickens, the pigs, the dogs, the cats, you know. And it's these kinds of practices that I guess are inherent in, you know, Filipino life, that we've sort of become somehow so disconnected from those cycles, and how to be responsible with life and resources. And so that was another sort of messaging that I remembered, it stuck with me, oh yeah, that's something that I really appreciate. You know, Filipinos, we might not talk about, my mom will never talk about, you know, being sustainability or environmental sustainability, but it's it's inherent in some of her practices. I see her wash dishes and the way she saves soap.
Water.
You know, or water. Yeah, she even washes it in the basin and then takes the water, the dirty water, and waters the plants. You know, it's there's these kinds of things that they do that we just kind of, they might not talk about sustainability, but their lifestyles are in a way that's very conscious, you know? Yeah, so that's very interesting, I feel.
So hello, this is Sheena coming back in. So it's one thing to break down your work for a global audience, but how do you explain what you do to your family in this case? You know, are there any personal stories that you can share about your work and how that's impacted them or shown up in your own life?
This is such a good question, but such a hard question for me. I will just admit that I'm the black sheep of my family. They all think I'm granola, and I get it. You know, to be honest, I don't think they pay much attention to me. I mean, I'm thinking about my mom and my my brother, Cheryl, knows my brother. yeah, they keep me humble, basically. You know, I think maybe over time I've seen, you know, small shifts in maybe what my mom purchases. I don't know if I've been able to influence my brother at all. He kind of is he's doing his own thing. But the small shifts, I would say, is I see my mom sometimes buying like organic produce from time to time, which is nice. But, you know, like I will admit that I think I didn't have the best approach early on in my younger days. You know, like my approach has certainly changed over time. I think I'm less aggressive and self-righteous about it, because I've realized like to be so confrontational isn't a very effective way of delivering any kind of message or being convincing. And I've failed miserably time and time again with my family in doing so. And so I think these days what I really try to do is I share resources. Like, I don't know if you guys have heard of the Environmental Working Group. They put out a report. I think they put out a report. Is it every year or every couple of years? But they do their Dirty Dozen report, where they list like the dirtiest produce, like the ones that have the most chemicals on them. So I share things like that with them, so that I just kind of like don't buy, make sure you buy organic for these ones, you know, just to get them to buy a little bit more responsibly. And usually to convince them, I think what ends up being most compelling, at least for my mom, is, you know, the impact that, you know, a food product might have on her health. So if I can emphasize like, well, how is this, you know, bad for your health? How is this bad for your grandchildren's health? You know, like I try to take that angle so she can, you know, hopefully make better decisions in terms of what she buys. Maybe sometimes I'll talk about the impact on the environment, but it has to be a good day. It has to be a day where, like, you know, you could tell like, okay, they're actually interested. Maybe let me like go a step further and talk about like, you know, the whole sustainability lens of things. And then on the rare occasion, I think if I really have their attention, especially if like, you know, my nieces and nephews are tuning in and like everybody's trying to like show that they actually care about what I'm saying. I don't know if it's performative or what, but that's when I'll start to maybe talk about like the social justice implications and like to bring in that lens. But yeah, it has to be a very special occasion for that. I know everybody's families are different, and, you know, you're so, dinner conversations might be completely different. Your dynamics might be completely different. But from my family, it's a difficult thing, and it has always been a difficult thing for me to navigate. And I think that comes from just different challenges. You know, I mentioned, I think early on, that I'm first generation university graduate. So that already creates a dynamic within my family. That's difficult to navigate, right? And I'm still trying to figure that one out. There's also, you know, we're a first generation Filipino American, and so our my lens and understanding and place in the world is somewhat different than my mom's because of her upbringing in the Philippines. And so there's also that disconnect that we constantly have to try to bridge and navigate. And so I don't think I've found the answer to how to be compelling or how to have these conversations in the best way. I'm still very much learning. And I welcome anybody's thoughts or input on that and how they're like effective in talking with their own family members, because I think maybe it's an inherent challenge with like first generation, second generation Filipinos, you know? There's just that, there's some bridging that we have to do of frameworks and references.
I agree. I mean, I think that it's going to be a continuous challenge, but I think you hit the nail on the head. Leveraging the health aspect is probably the best way to lead into that conversation, because that's kind of universal for all of us, right? Especially as we all get a little bit older, both sides, I feel like. And actually, that's a good segue, because I'm sure there are others who are listening to this and may still be wondering, you know, what exactly does this have to do with health and wellness? So can you actually talk about the relationship of local food movements within the context of health and wellness?
Yeah. So I think if you think about local food movements, you know, they're fundamentally about transforming the food system, right? It's about reconnecting, and I hate the word consumer, so I'm not going to use consumers, but like reconnecting communities, you know, to places and people who are producing, processing, distributing, preparing the foods that they eat. It's also about, you know, making sure the ways we produce food align with our values, and need to ensure, you know, sort of this sustainability aspect. We need to ensure that, you know, farms are managed with sustainable practices, so that we aren't continuing to pollute our soils and our waters. We're not continuing to expose ourselves and farmers and farm workers to toxic chemicals, right? It's also about, you know, backing local farmers and community economic development to ensure that money and resources stay and circulate within our communities, rather than, you know, sort of leaving our communities. And I think it's also about, you know, making sure that we have access to foods and cuisines that have cultural meaning and significance to us, right? That foods, like Cheryl had mentioned earlier, I love this, Cheryl, what you said. I always say the same thing. Food holds memory, right? We want to make sure that we have access to those foods that hold memory for us so that we can continue to make new memories with them. And so I think, yeah, food is super powerful. I think it's central to our health and wellness in so many different ways. And so being a part of, you know, the local food movement that will shape what food is actually available to you and how it's made available to you is really critical, I think. And I'd love to see more Filipinos being a part of that space.
Actually, that's a great segue, because the next question was, if there's one hope that you have for the Filipino community within the realm of health and wellness overall, you know, what would that be? And if so, how do you see your work as contributing to that vision?
This is a good question.
Do we raise some hard ones for you?
Yeah. No, it's just like it's a beautiful question, because it gets me to like think a little bit more deeply. I guess it's just, it comes back to, you know, something that I keep saying is, it's my hope that more Filipinos can be a part of these conversations, can be leaders in these spaces.
Yeah.
Can, you know, introduce larger communities and diverse communities to our food traditions and our cuisines, and, you know, share in making some new memories with, you know, foods that are valuable and meaningful for us. And I think we have such a rich history that I think that a lot of other demographic groups, other immigrants, will have resonance with, you know, it can be, we can serve as a bridge in diverse communities, and, you know, bringing people together, creating that social belonging and that social connection. And that's often done through food. And I know Filipino food is becoming very sexy. You know, there are some really incredible restaurants that are popping up, food trucks that are popping up, you know, various like Filipino-owned businesses that are in the food space that are popping up. And it's super sexy. People are into it. And yeah, because it's delicious. And because, you know, there's it's not only delicious, but there's usually like a really incredible story to go along with the different cuisines that are being made and filling our bellies and being shared in communities. And so Yeah, and I haven't even touched on, I mean, I mentioned it quite briefly earlier, but, you know, we have a stake in the game as well, right? We have a history in as farm workers. We have a long history as also farmers, that indigenous farmers in the Philippines. And so connecting with that and learning from that and using that to shape what our local food systems can look like, I think could be very powerful. And I'm excited to see how it could transform our local food systems. And so I'm just, I just have full confidence and a lot of hope in, you know, Filipinos and what they could bring to the table.
Thanks, Amber. I mean, we have some questions that are going to get us to the closing of the episode, but I know you had questions for us.
Oh, yeah. Well, you guys have been asking so many questions about, you know, like how the local food movement, like, why do I think this is so important? Like, how does it speak to, or why is it resonant with the Filipino diaspora community? And I just wanted to hear, like, based off of everything that we talked about today, like, what do you think will resonate with your listeners? Like, what do you think that they'll find to be important, or what will they sort of latch on to? Whoever wants to go first.
You can start, Cheryl.
What will they latch on to? I think just having a deeper understanding or reflection on where food is sourced. As you mentioned, we talked about disconnection earlier, and how generations after us are responding to, I don't know, food comes from the grocery, right? But I think what's valuable is, and this has been the running theme of the week in conversations that I've had, is providing historical context to what we interact with on the daily. So because we're health and wellness, an integral part for me of wellness in our community is our connection to the land. So I have a tattoo in the back of my spine, which is Bathala, right? Mm-hmm. So Bathala is like in the Tagalog region or the northern region of the Philippines, refers to the creator. But when you break that down even further, I was told Bathala, broken down in Babayan or Philippine indigenous script, represents the connection between the babae, the lalake, which is the la, but the ta also represents the land. And so when you look at how we refer to Bathala as a creator in the northern region, we have this connection as people to our land. When that disconnects, that impacts our wellness.
Yeah.
As we no longer are able to connect ancestrally to the mannerisms, the way of life of how our ancestors connected to their motherland. And so, as you mentioned earlier, being in liminal spaces, our whole diaspora, if you think about it, is living in these liminal spaces.
Yeah.
Because we're forced to migrate to other countries many times to survive economically and contribute back to a country where we no longer can financially sustain ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, there are a lot of things that impact wellness, not just in looking at it from an intergenerational trauma perspective, but when we're talking about local food to Kamayan, even when, as you mentioned throughout this entire episode, when we engage in even the foods that we eat at our family parties, we also don't always have access to the rice farmers that have created the rice that we're eating.
Yeah.
The process of the lechon and what it took to not only feed that pig, but also the sacrifice it takes to take that life of the pig away so that we can enjoy it. You know, those are things that are very sacred to us as Filipinos, but also we lose that, and in losing that and the absence of that, I think there are also impacts on our overall health and wellness and not being able to have that direct connection. I don't know if like I'm answering your question, but for me, those are some of the deeper takeaways as I'm listening to you talk about it in this episode, and why, you know, we can't necessarily always go back to the farm, especially for urban dwellers, right? To raise a pig in our backyard or chickens in our backyard and always get the eggs directly without a neighbor complaining about the rooster noises or the chicken noises, right? But it's important for us to have a deeper hand in knowing that connection, because with that reconnection, to me, comes our wellness.
Yeah, you know, I completely hear you, Cheryl. And it made me think about some of like the indigenous worldviews that I've been exposed to, especially up here in BC, like health and wellness frameworks for indigenous peoples are really centered on their relationship with land and the health and well-being of the land. Like they're one and the same. And I'm not indigenous, and so I won't you know, even sort of try to dive into the details and misrepresent, you know, some of those frameworks. But I will say that that is some of the messaging that gets conveyed. And it's a really important and powerful one, I think. And I think there's a lot to learn from those frameworks and those worldviews in terms of how to respect the land, how to respect life on the land, how to live responsibly and respectfully, and how all of that, your relationship to the land, has a direct impact on your health and well-being. I think they say it in a very beautiful way, very similar to what you were sort of describing. And, you know, it just makes me think, like, I think this is central to all of our lives, but the way we talk about it is quite different sometimes. And, but fundamentally, it's the same, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I also want to connect with and resonate with what you were mentioning about, there are other parts of your conversation that resonated. Also, the chemicals, the pesticides, the fungicides, the water contamination. As people, we're ingesting that into our bodies. Yeah. And that we're talking about health and wellness here. That's also altering our bodies biologically, our health biologically. We're coming out with now these health outcomes that are pretty unique to living in the Western world that not everyone always experiences in the Philippines if they are ingesting food directly in an organic way and not in a conventional way. You mentioned there's also conventional farms there too. So not everyone is taking in organic foods. But how does that also impact our health, right? We have a high number of diabetes and high blood pressure in our communities. And I often think about how colonialism has played into how also our foods have been altered for in a sense, right? We talk about colonialism and its impact on mental health. We talk about colonialism and its impact on our families and generations. We don't always talk about, because it might be taboo, because food is our love language, but how colonialism impacts our food.
Mm-hmm.
And how that in turn also impacts our health. We've also had guests like that have talked about like cultural perspectives of wellness. We don't always talk about the energy that food contains and how when we have a direct relationship to the land and to our food and to our crops, we are exchanging a symbiotic relationship of energy. Mm-hmm. As we care for plants, they too care for us. When we don't have that connection And there are other means of energy, or, you know, that is coming through the machine or through overproduction or through capitalism, we also ingest that energy. Mm-hmm. So I think those are things that I just wanted to mention as it relates to the conversation of health and wellness. That's my spiel. Sheena, do you have anything to add?
No, I agree with everything that you said, actually. And just to add on to it, for me, a lot of it is how do we continue bridging that gap and living with both dualities, right? As in caring about things now, but also honoring that tradition, because that's kind of where a lot of it boils down, is how do we do both? And because you can't just delete one and adopt the other. So realistically, especially if you want to make some of the other generations kind of lean in, a lot of it is bridging that gap. So I think that really resonates a lot.
I mean, the title of this episode is Local Food to Kamayan, right? Kamayan is the act of also eating with our hands.
Yeah.
When we ingest food with our hands and when we touch that food, that is also an exchange of energy. You know, when we replace it with a knife and a fork, we no longer have that physical touch, that connection to the food. And so something even simple as that can really impact now, as going full circle to that word that you mentioned, the disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to have conversations like this to have our community remember and reconnect to what is valuable and those relationships that sustain us. Because there is no disconnect between the land and the Philippines. We nourish it the way it nourishes us. So what are some projects, Amber?
Well, I love that.
Said. Or what is your feedback on that?
No feedback. And in terms of projects, I've got nothing, you guys. I'm transitioning into a new role, and so I'm just kind of dealing with that. I do have a book chapter that's coming out, but it's still early days. I don't really have the information about that yet, but I can keep you all posted. It'll be related to school food programs here in Canada.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm just trying to take care of these kids and, you know.
Yeah. What do you think about this conversation, though, about health and wellness in our community? Like, some of those things.
Yeah, I loved everything that you guys both said. I agree wholeheartedly. And, you know, I think maybe the one thought that I have, a follow-up thought, and I think it's, we'll maybe bring everything together that the two of you had just said, but is I think that we just need to expand, you know, how we define health. So health isn't just about like our individual experiences and our individual bodies, but it's also about like community health, environmental health, because we're very much connected, right? We're embedded in our communities, we're embedded in the environment, we're part of the land, we're part of this planet. And so our health is intricately embedded in all of those things. And so when we think about health and wellness, we have to consider the wider health and wellness of our communities. We have to consider the wider health and wellness of the environment. And I think when we do that, we'll achieve a more holistic sort of health and wellness.
Agreed. I want to just bring in and shout out a spirit friend that had passed in my community that is coming to the forefront of this episode, Saraya Medina, the late Saraya Medina. She's very beautiful Boricua Filipina that was really a part of food systems in the local area of Los Angeles that we're at. And she's just coming to the forefront right now as we're talking about this, because I think she was all about having our communities engage in local farmers and just eating healthier and having
chemicals in our households that were not only healthy for us, but for our children.
Being that we're a health and wellness podcast, this is something that we ask everyone, Amber. You're a mom, you're a wife, you're my best friend. you are a social ecology, environmental design, and food systems expert. How do you achieve your own health and wellness? How do you balance it all? We ask every guest this. And so what are your tips?
I need help. yeah, seriously, though, I need help. I don't know if I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say that I'm balancing at all. I will say that it's definitely a struggle at times, but I had to have to really think about it. I'll say that, you know, there are a few things that I absolutely love to do, and it does bring me peace, and it does have an impact on my health and well-being. And it's one, I love gardening. I love it. I recently moved and I lost my garden and I have to start all over again, but that's okay. It's very exciting. And for reasons I can't get into, I can't do it this year, but I'm super excited for next year. But like gardening, growing my own food, harvesting directly from my garden and preparing that food, it's just such a beautiful thing. And then seeing my kids also just like, you know, pick raspberries off the canes and put them directly into their mouth, or pick jostaberries directly off of our tree and put them directly into their mouth. I love that, and they love it. I think there is something quite beautiful. And like, I love knowing that they are a part of like growing food, and they understand, like, you know, seed grows into a plant and flowers turn into fruits and pollinators. Like I've been instilling that kind of knowledge and understanding in them. And so, yeah, that means a lot to me. I do love cooking from scratch as well. But the only thing is, like, I never have time. If I had more time, I wish I could do a little bit more of it. Because I just love, yeah, I love having all of that scratch food cooking and giving that to my kids and them getting to taste all of that love that I put into it. I do try to go to yoga, Pilates, and bar classes at this local studio 3 to 4 times a week. But some weeks are tough, right? And I don't go at all. So that's when I need a little bit of help. I also hate driving. I love walking everywhere. And luckily I live in an area where I can walk to a lot of places that I frequent. So that's quite nice. And then I do a lot of outdoor stuff. My husband, I think he's undergoing his midlife crisis. And so he bought a canoe recently. So we've already started canoeing a lot. So we're going to be doing a lot of canoeing this summer. That was his big purchase, a canoe. I'm all right with that, you know. It's not so bad, and I feel like it's a healthy purchase. I also like hiking. I think, you know, I was raised Catholic, as so many of us are. Had to go to church extra because I was a girl. My brother didn't have to go on Tuesdays like I did for some reason. Well, that reason being because I was a girl, I was told. But and I hope I don't offend anyone, but going to church didn't stick with me. I was never really inspired by it. It didn't move me in the same way that it moves my mom. But what does move me, what I do find a lot of peace in, and where I do find some grace, is being outdoors and hiking. And so I do a lot of forest bathing by myself or with my family. And that's my church.
Awesome. We'll have to do something on forest bathing, actually. That's a good one to bring up and talk more about.
As we begin to close, Amber, please, or Dr. Heckelman, please remind our community how to reach you. If they have additional questions after listening to this episode on local foods to combine.
Yeah, probably the best way to reach me is find me on LinkedIn. You know, just search my name, Amber Heckelman. Or you can even reach me directly by sending me an email. That's fine, too. That's just my name, amber.heckelman@gmail.com. And I'd love to hear from you. So please don't hesitate to reach out.
Okay. And final word, is there anything else that you would want our community to know when it comes to supporting local food movements?
Yeah. I think we've already touched on a lot of this. And so I'm just going to be recapping some of the conversation that's already unfolded already. But I just want to really underscore, emphasize that food is everything. It's what sustains us. It's central to how we celebrate our lives and our traditions. It holds some of our fondest memories, as Cheryl had mentioned. And it's really how we connect with the people we love. You know, it's how we connect with our neighbors and how we connect with our communities. Food is also how we explore the world oftentimes, right? It's how we explore different cultures and traditions. It's how we gain a glimpse into other people's hearts and the regions they're from. And it's through eating their food, right? So food holds a lot of power. It's a powerful connector in a world that feels very disconnected at times, right? And so I just hope that your listeners can hold on to that and remember that. And I hope more and more Filipinos, you know, sort of tap into that power. And I know so many already are, but there's definitely room for more. And I'll leave it there.
There's this hashtag that the young people use, which is food is life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Food is life.
It is. I agree with that hashtag 100%.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Heckelman. We know we're so grateful to walk alongside you as you continue offering healing and wellness to the community. You know, we're excited to witness your journey as it unfolds and continues, especially in the spaces of local food movements and food systems and environmental justice. So please be sure to tag us in your future projects. We'd love to stay connected and help amplify any important work that you're doing.
Thanks so much, Sheena. And thank you both for your questions. It was it was really amazing to be able to sit and reflect on these questions and really think deeply. And so I really appreciate that opportunity to do that.
Well, we are grateful for you.
No, thank you.
No. Thank you.
And to our community, for our next episode, we're happy to invite back to our podcast Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino of Love Life from our previous season to talk to us about melatonin, vitamin D, and sleep. I for sure will need that. So stay tuned as this episode will air on Wellness Wednesday, August 13th. And as we close, we'd like to acknowledge once again our guest speaker, Dr. Amber Heckelman, our creative lead, Richie, our video editor, Harmony Tangunan Kawan, our social media strategist and development coordinator, Kathleen Torrio, our outreach manager, Maya Custodio, our advisors, Allison De La Cruz, Rian De Los Reyes, and Safo Tulogo, our community partners, SoCal Filipinos, the Filipino American Life, Rising Filipinas, Therapinay, and all of our community members for your shares and support. As always, we'll be sharing more about our guests' work on our IG stories and highlights to learn more and access their upcoming events. Please make sure to follow us on @PhilippineX in Wellness and on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. And don't forget to hit the like and subscribe button on our YouTube channel. Thank you again for believing in us and for being part of this community. Be well, everyone. Continue to take care of yourselves and each other. Maraming salamat.
Salamat, Gid.